Turn to Proverbs chapter 20. Now, every day I've been saying we're not going fast enough and we're going to go faster today. But we never have really gone any faster. We, if anything, seem to be going slower the further we get along. So we're actually a couple of days behind because of our slowness in Proverbs. But as you've been with us and paying attention, you see that it's kind of difficult to just rush through a book that has so many different subjects demanding our attention in one chapter even. But we will try to go faster this time, again I say. And what I'd like to do again as last time is read the whole chapter, more or less without comment, and then go back and comment on a few verses. The verses that we make no comment on will be verses which either are self-explanatory or which I don't myself have any more light on to give you than just reading the verse, or which I just don't have any comments to make about. Chapter 20. Wine is a mocker. Strong drink is raging. And whosoever is deceived thereby is not wise. The fear of a king is as the roaring of a lion. Whoso provoketh him to anger. Start from the beginning? All right. Let's read now. Proverbs chapter 20. Wine is a mocker, strong drink is raging, and whosoever is deceived thereby is not wise. The fear of a king is as the roaring of a lion. Whoso provoketh him to anger sinneth against his own soul. It is honor for a man to cease from strife, but every fool will be meddling. The sluggard will not plow by reason of the cold. Therefore shall he beg and harvest and have nothing. Counsel in the heart of man is like deep water, but a man of understanding will draw it out. Most men will proclaim every one his own goodness, but a faithful man who can find? The just man walketh in his integrity. His children are blessed after him. A king that sitteth in the throne of judgment scattereth away all evil with his eyes. Who can say, I have made my heart clean, I am pure from my sin? Diverse weights, diverse measures, both of them are alike abomination to the Lord. When a child is known by his doings, whether his work be pure and whether it be right. The hearing ear and the seeing eye, the Lord hath made even both of them. Love not sleep, lest thou come to poverty. Open thine eyes, and thou shalt be satisfied with bread. It is not, saith the liar. But when he is gone his way, then he boasteth. There is gold and a multitude of rubies, but the lips of knowledge are a precious jewel. Take his garment that is surety for a stranger, and take a pledge of him for a strange woman. Bread of deceit is sweet to a man, but afterwards his mouth shall be filled with gravel. Every purpose is established by counsel, and with good advice make war. He that goeth about as a talebearer, a gossip, revealeth secrets. Therefore meddle not with him that flattereth with his lips. Whoso curseth his father or his mother, his lamp shall be put out in obscure darkness. An inheritance may be gotten hastily at the beginning, but the end thereof shall not be blessed. Say not thou, I will recompense evil, but wait on the Lord, and he shall save thee. Diverse weights are an abomination to the Lord, and a false balance is not good. Man's goings are of the Lord. How can a man then understand his own way? It is a snare to the man who devoureth that which is holy, and after vows to make inquiry. A wise king scattereth the wicked, and bringeth the wheel over them. The spirit of a man is the candle of the Lord, searching all the inward parts of the belly. Mercy and truth preserve the king, and his throne is upholden by mercy. The glory of young men is their strength, and the beauty of old men is the gray head. The blueness of a wound cleanseth away evil. So do stripes the inward parts of the belly. All right, well, this there's a lot of good verses to make comments on. The first one, makes mention of the fact that a person who is deceived by wine is not wise. There's more about wine to be found in chapter 23, verses 29 and following. It says, "Who hath woe? Who hath sorrow? Who hath contention? Who hath babbling? Who hath wounds without cause? Who hath redness of eyes? They that tarry long at the wine, and they that go to seek mixed wine. Look not thou upon the wine when it is red, when it giveth its color in the cup, when it moveth itself aright. At the last it biteth like a serpent, and stingeth like an adder. Thine eyes shall behold strange women, and thy heart shall utter perverse things. Yea, thou shalt be as he that lieth down in the midst of the sea, or as he that lieth upon the top of a mast. They have stricken me, shalt thou say, and I was not sick. They have beaten me, I felt it not. When shall I awake? I will seek it yet again." Description of a drunkard. The man who has sorrow, the man who has woe, the man who has redness of eyes, the man who has babblings, the man who has contentions. Who is that? The man who tarries long at the wine. And he says that a man who goes for that will find that it stings like a poisonous serpent or bites like an adder. And it says that he will cause his eyes to behold strange women. It'll cause him to have immoral conduct, because once a person is overcome by wine or any drug, his judgment is befuddled and his moral character is diminished. And so it breaks down his defenses against immorality. Also, it says your mouth shall utter perverse things, meaning that you'll say things that you'll wish later you hadn't said. Also, it says you'll be like one who gets, you'll get beat up but won't even feel it. You'll be like one who falls asleep at the top of the mast of a ship. In other words, you know how that would bob around like that. Just talking about seasickness, in other words. It's talking about vomiting and all that. And then it says, but yet, the person is such a fool that even though he has all these negative consequences for his drinking, yet he says, "When shall I arise? I'll seek it yet again." So he's addicted. It says in this verse, chapter 20 and verse 1, wine is a mocker. And you can see how that description we just read in chapter 23 actually shows wine mocking the person who is addicted to it. It makes him look like a fool. Strong drink is raging, and whoever is deceived by it is not wise. Verse 3 says, "It is an honor for a man to cease from strife, but every fool will be meddling," or will be stirring up strife. It's the honor of a man to cease from striving, from arguing. It's the honorable thing to do. Many times when we're in the midst of an argument, we don't want to give up the argument until we can determine that we've won it. And of course, if we're arguing against a stubborn opponent, he will never give up either. And at a certain point, the honorable thing is just to desist, even though your opponent has not conceded that you are correct. And by your ceasing to argue, it may appear as though you have a weaker position and that you've been scared away from the argument. But in fact, the Bible says it's an honor to cease from strife. It is your glory, it is your honor to control your spirit, as we said earlier. The man that controls his spirit is better than the man who can take a city. And a fool will be stirring up strife, but a wise man and honorable will be honored by God for ceasing from strife. More about the sluggard in verse 4. More about counsel and wisdom in verse 5. Verse 6 says, "Most men will proclaim every one his own goodness, but a faithful man who can find?" It's easy to hear people who talk about how good they are, but where can you find one who really is, it says. And we're reminded of the Pharisees, especially as Jesus described them in Matthew 6:2, when he said that we should not be like the hypocrites who are play-acting at righteousness. Also in other places in Proverbs, in chapter 25 and verse 14, it says, "Whoso boasteth himself of a false gift is like clouds and wind without rain." It's easy to find people who boast about how gifted they are, but if it's a false boast of a false gift, then of course it's like when you see a cloud coming, you expect rain, but it's like a cloud that comes that doesn't have any rain. He causes you to expect something from him, but there's nothing there. Chapter 27 and verse 2 also, "Let another man praise thee, and not thine own mouth. a stranger and not thine own lips. Proverbs 27:2. Let another person praise you, not yourself. Most men will proclaim everyone's own goodness, but it's not very common to find a person who's as good as they talk about themselves. It says in verse 8 and also in verse 26 that the presence of a king, and verse 26 says a wise king, but verse 8 just says a king, in authority scatters away evil from before his eyes. That is simply to say that where the final authority is, where there is someone who has authority, there is order and there is righteousness that can prevail. Where there is no final authority, then evil can never be scattered. It says in Romans 13 and also in 1 Peter chapter 2 that the authorities that are in existence in government are there for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of them that do well, and that God has ordained them for that purpose. Because without governmental authority, there would be chaos. Or as it says in the final verse of the book of Judges, in those days there was a king in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes, which usually wasn't what was right in God's eyes. And so there's the need for authority. There's a need for leadership to avoid everyone doing what's right in their own eyes. Many people, what's right in their own eyes is very evil. And so the presence of a king, the presence of a final court of appeal, makes possible the elimination of injustice, as long as it's a wise king and a just one. Verse 10 and 23 both talk about diverse weights and a false balance or diverse measures. Again, this has to do with the marketplace where instead of using gold coins, many times they just weigh out one item against another. Either maybe they'd weigh out gold or something like that, or else they'd barter in commodities. They'd maybe trade a certain amount of wheat for a garment or something, and they would have to use the scales to determine how much wheat they were giving. I mean, they did very much more on scales to understand how much money was being paid, because they had to weigh it out when they didn't have coinage. And of course, a perverse and an unrighteous seller would have a scale that had false weights that were not accurate, so that he could get more money out of people and they wouldn't know it, because he'd be measuring what they were paying out against a false balance. And so it says those things are abomination to the Lord. We've been told that before, and also here in verses 10 and 23. Further on a similar point is verse 14. It is not, saith the buyer, but when he has gone his way, then he boasteth. Now, it is not means it's nothing or it's worthless. Now, what it's saying is the man in the market who's buying something, and of course, you know the Middle Eastern custom of bickering and dickering, I should say, over prices, and this still goes on in Tijuana and probably a lot of places where people are not don't have hard and fast prices where you can sort of talk them down on the price. Of course, the buyer then is the one who's always going to say to the seller, oh, that thing's practically worthless. It's nothing. It's nothing. It's no good at all. I'm not going to give you a penny more than, you know, 5 cents for that thing because it's worthless. But it says, though he says that when he's in the process of buying, yet when he goes his way, he boasts about what he got. It's like at the flea market, you know. You know, when you go there, you try to, I mean, you shouldn't, but many times people will try to convince the seller that what they're selling isn't worth the price they're asking, and you'll talk them down and get it a little cheaper. When you go away, you say, look at this great thing I got for just 25 cents. And that's what it's saying there. And that, again, has to do with a false weight, a false balance, only not a real weight and real balance. It's more has to do with a false standard. That on one hand, in one situation, you're saying this is worthless, but when you go around to another, in another situation, you say it's a great deal. And it's using diverse weights, diverse measures to evaluate the value of something. Verse 18. He that goeth about as a talebearer revealeth secrets. Therefore meddle not with him that flattereth with his lips. Have nothing to do with a gossip. Verse 22. Say not thou, I will recompense evil, but wait on the Lord, and he shall save thee. Now, I will recompense evil means I'll get my revenge. Don't say that. Don't seek vengeance. This is a New Testament concept. It's also found elsewhere in the book of Proverbs. In Proverbs 24:29, it says, "Say not, I will do so to him as he hath done to me. I will render to the man according to his work." So don't say that. Don't say you'll render to a man according to his work and do to him as he did to you. Jesus said, "Do unto others not as they do to you, but as you would have them to do to you." And over in Romans 12, we have the classic New Testament text on non-vengeance. Verse 17, Romans 12:17, "Recompense no man evil for evil. Provide things honest in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath, for it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord.' Therefore, if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. For in so doing, thou shalt heap coals of fire on his head. Not overcome with evil, but overcome evil with good." What this is saying is that when someone does evil to you, then you are tempted to do evil back. And if you do evil back to a person who's done evil to you, then you have been overcome by that very evil. Now, that person's evil doing to overcome you and to twist your character and to make you do a wrong thing. But it says, don't be overcome with evil, but overcome evil with good. When a man does something evil to you, you don't have to succumb to that evil and do something evil back. You can overcome that evil. That is, the temptation that you have to do evil back, you can overcome it by doing good for the man. You feed your enemy when he's hungry. You give him drink when he's thirsty. You help him. As Jesus said in Matthew, love your enemies. Do good to those who persecute you. Pray for those who despitefully use you. And here he says, give place to wrath. He says, in verse 19, do not avenge yourselves, a straight out command, but give place to wrath. Now, what's that mean, give place to wrath? I believe what it's saying is that God's wrath will be upon anyone who afflicts you, his children. The Bible makes that clear. God is your defense. And if people hurt you, then God's wrath will deal with them in his time. But if you avenge yourself, then God won't avenge you. You've got a choice. You can avenge yourself, or you can let God do it. If you do not avenge yourself, then you give place to God to send his wrath in due time and in proper measure. Because he might also see the offense as less great than you do, and he can more justly measure out whatever vengeance or wrath is due to a person for what they've done. But you might see the thing all out of perspective and measure out more punishment to the person than is really worthy of the crime. So the idea is, as Christians, we just take it. We let people do to us what they want to do to us, and we don't avenge ourselves. Non-resistance is something Jesus taught and is here also enforced. And we, by not avenging ourselves, we give place to God to send his wrath and to avenge at his time and in his way. If we do avenge ourselves, God, I suppose, doesn't bother to do so. The teaching of Jesus on that is in Matthew 5, 38 through 48. Also, Paul had something more to say about it in 1 Thessalonians 5, 15. And he said, "See that none render evil for evil unto any man, but ever follow that which is good, both among yourselves and to all men." So it has to do not only with evil that is done by a non-Christian, but also evil done by a Christian, but evil done by a non-Christian, no matter who it is. Some people might say, "Well, I won't take a Christian to court, but I'll take a non-Christian to court." No, he says, not only among yourselves, but also to all men. Do not render evil for evil or avenge yourself or defend yourself. Now, I don't think that if you avenge yourself that you'll necessarily go to hell for doing so, but you will cheat yourself. Because you will have allowed evil in that instance to overcome you. And you will have also deprived yourself of God coming to your defense in the situation. So I recommend this verse. "Say not thou, I will recompense evil, but wait on the Lord, and he shall save thee." Verse 24 says, "A man's goings are of the Lord. How can a man then understand his own way?" Again, we see the idea that God is sovereign. God is the one who really determines where you're going to end up. Not necessarily in the sense of where you're going to end up eternally, but your path in life. Where you'll be successful, where you'll be unsuccessful, where you'll find a home and where you'll be unable to find a home. Things like that. Those things are of the Lord. The Lord has to, it's providence that works everything out for your good. Therefore, a man cannot fully understand his way. That means we need to walk not by faith, not by sight, but by faith. We need to walk not leaning on our own understanding, but trusting in the Lord. We don't know what the future holds, so we trust in Him day by day to lead us. Because we can't understand our own goals. We don't know what the future holds. But God does. Going down to verse 29, the glory of young men is their strength, but the beauty of old men is the gray head. A young man, of course, in his day of strength, can do more, can accomplish more. Perhaps, and he's not, as a young man, he's not all that wise yet, but when he gets older, his strength wanes, but his wisdom hopefully increases. If he's followed the way of righteousness, his knowledge of God and his general wisdom only increases. And so he will, that's his, as he grows older, the wisdom and the benefits of old age, which are other than physical strength, place physical strength as something that is desirable in a man. Now, verse 30, the blueness of a wound cleanseth away evil, so do stripes, the inward parts of the belly. The word belly there simply means the inward parts of your person, of yourself. Now, the blueness of a wound, speaking of a black and blue bruise, is, of course, the result of being whipped or being corrected, and corrected painfully. And if you undergo correction, though sometimes it be painful, the result will be health. The result will be cleansing away evil. And in Hebrews chapter 12, it tells us that we should not despise the chastening of the Lord, because He scourges or whips every son whom He receives. But He does it for our benefit, that we might be partakers of His holiness, so that we should receive wounds from God cheerfully. We should receive correction, though it be painful correction, because it will cleanse away evil, and that's the intention of God in it. Going on to chapter 21 now. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. As the rivers of water, He turneth it whithersoever He will. Every way of a man is right in his own eyes, but the Lord pondereth the hearts. To do justice and judgment is more acceptable to the Lord than sacrifice. And a high look and a proud heart and the plowing of the wicked is sin. The thoughts of the diligent tend only to plenteousness, but every one that is hasty only to want or to lack. The getting of treasures by a lying tongue is a vanity tossed to and fro of them that seek death. The robbery of the wicked shall destroy them, because they refuse to do judgment. The way of a man is froward and strange, but as for the pure, his work is right. It is better to dwell in the corner of a housetop than with a brawling woman in a wide house. The soul of the wicked desireth evil. His neighbor findeth no favor in his eyes. When the scorner is punished, the simple is made wise. And when the wise is instructed, he receiveth knowledge. The righteous man wisely considereth the house of the wicked, but God overthroweth the wicked for their wickedness. Whoso stoppeth his ears at the cry of the poor, he also shall cry himself, but shall not be heard. A gift in secret, or a bribe, pacifieth anger, and a reward in the bosom, strong wrath. It is a joy to the just to do judgment, but destruction shall be to the workers of iniquity. The man that wandereth out of the way of understanding shall remain in the congregation of the dead. He that loveth pleasure shall be a poor man. He that loveth wine and oil shall not be rich. The wicked shall be a ransom for the righteous, and the transgressor for the upright. Better to dwell in the wilderness than with a contentious and angry woman. There is treasure to be desired and oil in the dwelling of the wise, but a foolish man spendeth it up. He that followeth after righteousness and mercy findeth life, righteousness, and honor. A wise man scaleth the city of the mighty and casteth down the strength of the confidence thereof. Whoso keepeth his mouth and his tongue keepeth his soul from troubles. Proud and haughty scorner is his name, who dealeth with proud wrath. The desire of the slothful killeth him, for his hands refuse to labor. He coveteth greedily all day long, but the righteous giveth and spareth not. The sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination. How much more when he bringeth it with a wicked mind? A false witness shall perish, but a man that heareth speaketh constantly. A wicked man hardeneth his face, but as for the upright, he directeth his way. There is no wisdom, nor understanding, nor counsel against the Lord. The horse is prepared against the day of battle, but safety is of the Lord. All right. Verse 2 says, well, verse 1 we can't skip. Again, about God's sovereignty over kings. God says that the king's heart, or the power of him to make decisions, is in the hand of God, and therefore God directs it whithersoever he will. We talked about this at length when we were in chapter 16, which tells even more about that. It says a divine sentence is in the mouth of a king, and he transgresseth not in judgment. Hard words for us to understand how they could be true. But when we remember that God uses evil governments to bring judgment upon an evil nation, then we can see why this is even true, that even an evil government can be seen as coming from the hand of God as punishment for the evil people in it and as a test to the righteous in it. Because the righteous then come under persecution, and that is a test and a purifying process for them. As far as the wicked, they are just getting what they deserve. And so even ungood rulers, God is directing them, the Bible says. Now, it doesn't say that every thought that every man ever has is put there by the Lord, as though God just manipulates everyone like totally like puppets. But we can be sure that God's sovereignty permits him and compels him to oversee at least major decisions of that have to do with the fate of other people in all of our lives. God will not allow us to carry out plans that are against his will if they are going to affect negatively someone else, or even positively someone else, if it's not his plan to bless them. He supervises that. And when a person is a king, of course, his decisions affect other people or whole nations, so that God takes it upon himself especially to intervene and interfere with the thought processes of leaders. And it is, of course, we're told in 1 Timothy 2, our duty and privilege to tell God, or to ask God, what thoughts to put in the kings. That we are actually to control the rulers by our prayers, because God's hand controls them. That's 1 Timothy 2, verses 1 through 3, I guess. Verse 2. Every way of a man is right in his own eyes, but the Lord pondereth the hearts. Meaning that what's right in your own eyes may not be necessarily right in God's eyes, but God is looking at the heart and knows whether the person's ways are right or not, and whether they're coming from pure motives. To do justice and judgment is more acceptable to the Lord than sacrifice. We're reminded, of course, of where we're told that to obey is better than sacrifice in the was that the 17th or the 15th chapter of 1 Samuel? 15th, I guess. Yeah, 17th was where David slew Goliath. The 15th chapter of 2 Samuel, I'll read about verse 20-something, 22 or so. It says, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of lambs. So here, obedience is broken down into doing justice and judgment. And that these are things that God desires greater than sacrifice. We're reminded also of Hosea. All right. Let's go on down to verse 5. The thoughts of the diligent tend only to plenteousness, but everyone that's hasty only to lack or poverty, want. Now, the diligent is contrasted here not with the slothful, but with the hasty. Many proverbs contrast diligence with slothfulness. And yet this one is talking mainly about people who are hasty instead of diligent to consider something, to plan it out first. Diligence needs to be applied not only in the actual carrying out of a purpose, but in the planning out of that purpose initially. Those are two parts of diligence. The slothful man is the man who is not good at the carrying out of purposes. He's weak and or he's lazy and won't work. But the hasty man is the man who is not diligent in preparing and thinking out those things. So we see that the thoughts of the diligent, meaning his planning and his preparations, will tend to plenteousness because he's diligent to think things through. Skip down to verse 12. Perhaps you wanted me to make a comment about verse 9 and verse 19. I don't really think it needs any comment. I think it just stands as the Scriptures commends itself as true. It's better to dwell in a corner of a housetop than with a brawling woman in a wide house. And in verse 19, it is better to dwell in the wilderness than with a contentious and an angry woman. Now, not everything Solomon says about women is negative. He had some good things to say about women. He said, "He that findeth a wife findeth a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord." He said in chapter 12, a virtuous wife is a crown to her husband. And it says that houses, lands are the inheritance of fathers, but a virtuous wife or a prudent wife is of the Lord. And so there's many good things said about women. There's a description of a virtuous woman in chapter 31. But there are, Solomon is not he's not totally enraptured with womanhood so much that he doesn't see the realistic side, that the wrong kind of wife can be a very destructive influence. He said in one of the chapters we just read, he said, a wise woman buildeth her house. But she that is, verse 14, chapter 14, verse 1, she will buildeth her house, but the foolish plucketh it down with their hands. And that a foolish woman, an unvirtuous wife, can certainly make life not only miserable, but can do a lot of damage. He said it's better to just separate yourself temporarily, I imagine he means, from a wife who won't listen to reason. Verse 12, the righteous man wisely considereth the house of the wicked. God overthroweth the wicked for their wickedness. I think of this sort of on the same line as verse 22, a wise man scaleth the city of the mighty and casteth down the strength of the confidence thereof. The idea is that if a man is wise, he will scrutinize the weak positions of the house of the wicked or of his enemy. The enemy may be mighty in armies, but wisdom can beat might. The mighty man is overthrown by the wise man who scales the walls of his city. Verse 12 says that the righteous man wisely considers the house of the wicked, meaning he's checking it out. He's trying to find its weak points and all in order to overthrow it. But God overthrows the wicked for their wickedness. That verse 12 has a lot of italicized words, you might have noticed, and so it's kind of a choppy reading in the Hebrew and makes it a little difficult to be certain what it's saying. But it seems to connect, in my mind, with verse 22. Verse 13, whoso stoppeth his ears at the cry of the poor, he also shall cry himself, but not be heard. Just a description of poetic justice. If we're not merciful to the poor, then we will have our day being poor. And, Jesus said that when he gathers the sheep and the goats in Matthew 25, before his throne on the judgment day, he'll say, "Son, I was hungry and you did not feed me. I was naked and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison and you didn't visit me." And they'll say, "We don't remember. When did that happen?" And he'll say, "Inasmuch as you did it not unto one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it not unto me." It's very clear. He says, then they shall be, he shall say, "Depart from me, you cursed, into everlasting fire." I'll bet that's when they'll cry and not be heard. Not everyone who is merciless to the poor, not everyone who stops his ears at the cry of the afflicted necessarily enters into a time of poverty in this life, many of them die rich. But the day will come when they will cry and not be heard, even as they failed to hear the cries of the poor. The day when of judgment, they'll be crying out themselves, but their cries will be to no avail. Verse 18, the wicked shall be a ransom for the righteous, and the transgressor for the upright. The reason I picked that verse to speak on is not because it's so much a blessing, it's so much a difficult to understand. I thought you might need to look at that a little closer. It seems to be saying that the wicked will be taken instead of the righteous. There's another proverb earlier that said, the Lord delivereth the righteous out of a hard place, out of affliction. I forget the word exactly. But it says, and the wicked comes in his place. That means someone's got to be in affliction. And it's, by bringing the wicked in the place of the righteous, it's almost like, it's sort of figuratively like giving them as a ransom for the righteous, buying them out of prison, or buying them out of affliction. When God brings judgment on the earth, it will be because His people have not ruled earth, but and the wicked, that God is going to take the wicked and give their place to the righteous. And so He's giving the wicked as a ransom, or basically taking them as, putting His people in as replacements, or taking the wicked as replacements. It's a bit difficult concept, especially when you consider that in other places the Bible says that a man cannot give his life a ransom for another. No man can give, it says in Isaiah, I think it is. But it's saying essentially that God will take the wicked and replace the just. And that's, in a nutshell, what the germinal thought there is. We saw verse 22 already, a wise man scaleth the city of the mighty and casteth down the strength of the confidence thereof. Again, this the mighty man's confidence is in his might. But the wise man is able to overthrow him. We have historic precedents of that happening. One that happened in biblical times, that's described in the 5th chapter of Daniel, was when Cyrus marched under the walls of Babylon and overthrew it. Babylon was mightier than the Persians, but Cyrus surprised them and found their weak spot and went through and won. Verse 25, the desire of the slothful kills him, for his hands refuse to labor. He coveteth greedily all the day long, but the righteous giveth and spareth not. The desire probably means the appetite or the hunger of the slothful will eventually kill him. He'll die of hunger because he won't work. And he's all day long coveting someone else's stuff. He's wishing he had something, but he won't work for it. He's always on the take, but the righteous, by contrast, is always giving and sparing not, meaning he never ceases to give. He doesn't stop giving simply because he comes into a financially tight space, but he doesn't spare himself. He just keeps giving. He's a generous soul. Verse 27, the sacrifice of the wicked is abomination. How much more when he bringeth it with a wicked mind? That is to say, if a man is not living a righteous life, God will not be pleased in the first place with his prayers or his sacrifices or his obedience in outward things. And how much worse if he has a wicked motive for bringing it. Not all people who live wickedly always have a wicked motive for coming to church, but how much worse is it if a man is living an unrighteous life and then he comes also to church or to offer sacrifice to God with a wicked motive as well. A false witness shall perish, but the man that heareth speaks constantly. Now, the reason I mention that is because the last part of that verse, when we read it before, might have sounded like it conflicts with some of the other things we've read about wise men. Wise men spare words. In the multitude of words there lacks not sin, it says, and so forth. So it sounds here like a man who's smart, who's hearing, is always talking. But what I think it means is that man, the wicked witness, or the person who's wicked, will perish and his influence will cease. But that a man who's hearing, the man who's listening to God and also hearing reproof from men, I believe, is a man whose influence will endure. Though he dies, he still speaks. And we have examples of that in Hebrews. For instance, Hebrews 11:4 Hebrews 11:4 makes reference to Abel, how that through faith he offered the better sacrifice than his brother. It says, and he being dead yet speaketh. That is, he set an example that still speaks to us today. His influence remains because he heard and believed the word of God. Whereas the evil man, the false witness, will perish, and so will his influence. Verse 31, the horse is prepared against the day of battle, but safety is of the Lord. Now, this could be seen one of two ways. The part that's obvious is that safety is of the Lord. One way of seeing it could say, well, you should have your horses prepared against the day of battle, but as you go to battle, realize that the Lord is keeping you safe, that you've got your horses, you've done all you can, now you just trust God to do the rest. You fight your best and let God take care of the rest. But here, I believe what it's saying is, in spite of the fact that you've got horses prepared against the battle, they have nothing to do with your safety. Your safety has to do with whether the Lord's on your side or not. I don't think it's advocating preparing horses for battle. I'm just saying that though you have horses for battle, nonetheless, your safety does not rest in them. Let's go on into chapter 22 now. A good name is rather to be chosen than great riches, and loving favor rather than silver and gold. The rich and poor meet together. The Lord is the maker of them all. The prudent man foreseeth the evil and hideth himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. By humility and the fear of the Lord are riches and honor and life. Thorns and snares are in the way of the froward, a perverse man. He that doth keep his soul shall be far from them. Train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. The rich ruleth over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. That's for sure. Slavery. He that soweth iniquity shall reap vanity, and the rod of his anger shall fail. He that hath a bountiful eye, which means he's generous, shall be blessed, for he giveth of his bread to the poor. Cast out the scorner, and contention shall go out. Yea, strife and reproach shall cease. He that loveth pureness of heart, for the grace of his lips the king shall be his friend. The eyes of the Lord preserve knowledge, and he overthroweth the words of the transgressor. The slothful man saith, there is a lion outside. I shall be slain in the streets, therefore I can't go to work today. The mouth of strange women is a deep pit. He that abhorreth the Lord shall fall in it. Foolishness is bound in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction shall drive it far from him. He that oppresseth poor to increase his riches, and he that giveth to the rich shall surely come to want. Bow down thine ear and hear the words of the wise, and apply thine heart unto my knowledge. For it is a pleasant thing if thou keep them within thee. They shall withal be fitted in thy lips, that thy trust may be in the Lord. I have made known to thee this day, even to thee. Have not I written to thee excellent things in counsel and knowledge, that I might make thee know the certainty of the words of truth, that thou mightest answer the words of truth to them that send unto thee? Rob not the poor because he is poor, neither oppress the afflicted in the gate. For the Lord will plead their cause and spoil the soul of those that spoiled them. Make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man thou shalt go, not go. Lest thou learn his ways and get a snare to thy soul. Be not thou one of them that strike hands, nor of them that are sureties for debts. If thou hast nothing to pay, why should he take away thy bed from under thee? Remove not the ancient landmark which thy fathers have set. Seest thou a man diligent in his business? He shall stand before kings. He shall not stand before mean men or worthless, lowly, obscure men. Okay, let's do what we can to cover some of these verses well. The first verse is talking about the value of a good reputation. A good name is rather to be chosen than great riches, and loving favor rather than silver and gold. It's better to be well-loved than to be rich. It's better to be well-respected. Partly because you'll be better off anyway. You can lose your riches, but if you have a good reputation, you'll be taken care of if everyone loves you. You'll be taken care of by others if they respect you. But it's also just a good name is gotten by being good. And therefore, if you have a good name, it's likely that you're righteous. And that your good name extends even to God's opinion of you. And that's better than being rich. It says in verse 2, the rich and the poor meet together. The Lord is the maker of them all. What it means there is that while the rich and the poor don't really meet together very often or have much in common in the social life of most societies, yet in the fact that they are created both by God, they're equal. And before God, they meet together. They meet together in the church, for instance. The rich and the poor come into oneness in the church. But in secular society, they don't meet together very often. At the day of judgment, they'll certainly meet together. The rich and the poor will all be called equally before their maker. All the ground is level at the foot of the cross, they say. No one is up elevated any higher than anyone else. Verse 3, the prudent man flees the evil and hides himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. The idea of wisdom foreseeing hard times, foreseeing evil, thinking about what may be in the future, not fearing it, but seeing it reasonably, and making certain provisions. Now, earlier in the book, we read about the ant who foresees the time that winter will come and gathers extra food in summertime so that they'll have enough in the winter. And this was given as an exhortation for diligence to prepare for the future. We don't necessarily advocate that people store up food for future times of famine and hardship. In fact, this is against what Jesus said. Jesus said, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth. So we don't approve of that. But this gives us more the idea that you hide yourself or you find yourself a place of protection. In our case, our life is hid with Christ and God. That we find our safety in the Lord. That we make our relationship with the Lord strong and thus prepare ourselves for harder times. But a wise man will always be thinking in terms of future dangers and will make whatever the wisest preparation is for them. Again, some make wrong kinds of preparations for the evil day, thinking, you know, in the natural. But spiritual, of course, the best preparation to do is to enforce and strengthen our prayer life and our walk with God and all of that. But the wicked, or I should say the simple ones, the stupid ones, see the evil coming, they just pass along and they fall under trouble. Verse 6 says, train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. It doesn't say teach, but it says train. And to train is more than just to teach. You don't just tell children what's right and wrong, but training is actually a disciplinary process. And that's something that we need to understand. Training involves discipline. Training involves lessons that are not only verbal lessons, but just giving an example to them of the way things are supposed to be done, showing them how it's done, disciplining them when they don't do it correctly. That's all part of proper training. And so that's if you give yourself to the training of children, then they will not depart from the righteousness when they're old. Now, people have often said that they know of preachers' kids and other kids who are raised in Christian homes who are not Christians today and have departed from it. But I believe, and it may seem rather cold for me to say this, since my daughter's not old enough yet to be an example of one who, you know, who stayed or didn't stay with the Lord, but I believe the Scripture says if the man properly trains his children, that they will not depart. The fact that a person was raised in the church or raised in a Christian home or even a minister's home does not mean they were properly trained. In fact, very often the opposite is true. Many times ministers are so busy that they have hardly any time at all to train their children. And many times also in Christian families, which are families that are respected in the church, yet at home they don't set an example for their children or train their children properly, or they don't keep their children from bad influences like television and things like that. And so they don't, you know, we can't just say, well, this scripture can't be true because I've known a lot of people who raise their kids in Christian homes who their kids backslid. Well, that doesn't mean they train them upright. Training children is a full-time vocation. I wouldn't be surprised if God would expect some people to give up their jobs to to properly train their children. It would be worth it to live on rice for a year if it took that much of your time, you know, to take away from working for money to train your children right, to get your children back in line. Because they are something that you have to answer for. And the Bible makes a promise that if you train them correctly, then they will not depart from the ways of righteousness. That means if our children do depart, that we did something wrong. We can't just say, well, it's just, you know, the rebellious nature of a child. The Bible acknowledges there's a rebellious child. It says so even in a verse we read just today. It said that foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. But it says the rod of reproof will drive it far from him. And if that's the case, then it's clear that we can't argue about the rebellious nature of the child and suggest that that's the reason why our children backslid. It's that we did not train fully. And we must allow the full responsibility for our children's eternal fate to rest upon our training of them. And that's a pretty heavy thing to realize. And as I said, if a man had to give up all his other activities in order to properly train his children, I would consider that to be a wiser move. As long as he could still feed his family in some way or another, he has to provide for those of his household, the Bible says, or else he's not a Christian. But the training of children must come before the earning of money or recreational life or entertainment or, you know, advancement, social advancement, any of those things. And those are things that Christians as well as non-Christians often put before the spiritual well-being of their children. And it is a reproach. And it has come out. It shows. Parents let their children watch television and they let the heathen pump thoughts into their minds several hours of the day. And then they wonder why they reap such bad fruit when they've been sowing such bad seed. But the training of children should be, in some senses, a full-time thing. Because even when you're not directly disciplining or teaching them, your whole life is to be an example to them of what things are valuable and what are not. The man who sends his children to Sunday school but stays home himself is training his child, but not in the right way. He's given his child the message that Sunday school is good for children, but not for adults. And when the child starts to think of himself as an adult, he'll say, well, I guess I don't need church anymore. And we know some cases, probably all of us have friends whose parents sent them to church but never went themselves. And the parents said, what did we do wrong? Well, we sent them to Sunday school. Yeah, but they didn't train their children. They gave them the wrong message. Because they didn't provide an example themselves of piety and of the proper values. And just in general, give them an upbringing in the Lord and protect them from the worldly influences. We'll be responsible for those things. It says in verse 7, the rich rules over the poor and the borrower is the slave of the lender. Well, this simply means that a person who is in debt is a slave. A person who's borrowing money becomes a slave. He sells himself into slavery. It may not be that he becomes, technically speaking, the property of another person, but he's in slavery. And the Bible always advocates avoiding that situation. It said in 1 Corinthians 7, you have been bought with a price. Be not the slaves of men. Be not the slaves of men. He says, you slaves, don't care anything for it. I mean, don't seek your freedom. But he said, but if you have the opportunity to get your freedom, take it. So it's apparently not a sin to be a slave, but it's desirable, Paul said, to be free. To serve the Lord. And if you go into debt, well, you're not free. You're a slave. Verse 9 talks about generosity. Verse 10 says, if you cast out the scorner, contention will cease. That speaks of excommunication, I believe. In a church where there's contention and strife, you've got to throw out the person who's stirring it up. No less radical measures can solve the problem. Yea, strife and reproach shall cease. Okay. Verse 13 talks about how the flimsy excuses slothful people will make for not working. He says, oh, there's a lion in the streets. I'm afraid I'll be killed. Can't go to work today. And that basically the idea is that they just make up every excuse they can think of to avoid working. I've heard some excuses from slothful people that were not any less silly than this one. Verse 15 was where it said, foolishness is bound in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction shall drive it far from him. trying to find it. We don't have much time here. Let's see. Verse 24. Make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man thou shalt not go, lest thou learn his ways and get a snare to thy soul. Be not thou one of them. Oh, that's a different subject. But verses 24 and 25 tell us about friendships, and it suggests that your associates will mold you. There's always a danger of those who you choose as friends imparting to you their character. And so Proverbs speaks to the son of Solomon and advises him in a number of places, which we've seen before, to choose his friends carefully. And another proverb says, he that walketh with wise men shall be wise himself. But apparently if you make friendships with angry people, violent people, evil people, then you'll learn their ways. Then it talks about in verse 26 about going surety. That is getting yourself into a legally entangled situation financially with someone else. Then we've talked about that already. Verse 28, remove not the ancient landmark which thy fathers have set. That refers to the boundaries of the inheritance of their lands. When the Jews came into Israel with Joshua, the land was divided up and landmarks were set up to determine whose property ended where. And there were corrupt people who had moved the landmarks in order to extend their own property line further over. And it says that that's not, obviously that's something that's forbidden. It says, do you see a man who's diligent in business? He'll stand in the presence of kings. He won't stand before obscure men. So diligence in business will give you a place in among honorable people. Slothfulness, then of course, is just puts you along with the beggars in the street. Well, we'll take our break now. We've somehow managed to cover three chapters. And we'll look for three more, I hope, when we get back. Yes.